Republican U.S. Senator Ron Johnson completed his third year in office in January, so it's a great time to catch up with a Newsmakers interview with Senator Johnson. Senator, thanks for making time for us.
Oh, Steve.
You just got back from the Ukraine just over the weekend, a few days ago. Let me ask you this. Will Russia be happy with just getting Crimea back, or do you expect it to pursue more of reassembling what was the old Russia decades ago?
I'm afraid they won't be satisfied with it. And you look at Vladimir Putin's history, it would indicate that he won't be satisfied with just Crimea. I can tell you the prime minister, the president, they firmly believe that his aim isn't Crimea, it's really Kiev, which means that he really has designs on all of Ukraine. And of course, I'm concerned about the fact that Vladimir Putin has stated very publicly that the breakup of the Soviet Union was the greatest geopolitical catastrophe of the last century. And I think he means to reverse that catastrophe. And so we need to take him at his word. We need to understand that Vladimir Putin is not going to respond to words, tough talk. He will only respond to action. And we need to further understand that what makes Vladimir Putin strong is his oil wealth, the fact that Ukraine and so much of Europe is dependent on his oil wealth. And the other thing that makes him strong is our weakness. And so we need to show greater strength, we need to strengthen our economy, we need to show greater resolve in international affairs if we have any chance of dissuading him. And that's what we're talking about right now. Right now we're trying to dissuade Vladimir Putin from further expansion, further aggression.
What about economic sanctions, sir? Do you think those will work?
If they were extensive enough, if they were targeted enough, if they were painful enough. My disappointment is that President Obama sanctioned 7 Russians, 4 Ukrainians, and they laughed. They mocked the action. That's not a good sign when the people you're trying to cause pain are laughing at you. We need to get far more serious, and we need to make sure that Vladimir Putin and the people that support him, the oligarchs, the government officials that surround him, really pay a real price, experience a cost to what they have done, not only in Crimea, but Georgia, and what they may do in the future if they think they can continue to act this way with impunity. And that's really the signal they're getting right now, is that there's been no price to be paid for their unlawful activity.
What military aid should the United States be contemplating for the Ukraine, Senator?
Well, the Prime Minister was in Washington. We met with him there, plus we met with him in Ukraine, had a relatively simple request. Yanukovych totally hollowed out the Ukrainian military. That's a warning for us here as well. We better not hollow out our military. But even though they have more than 100,000 troops, there are only 6,000 troops, apparently, that are somewhat combat ready. They needed supplies. And we're supplying MRAs, that's good. But they also just asked for some small arms and ammunition so that they will defend themselves. They need the capability to defend themselves a little bit better than what there are. Our president, unfortunately, apparently rejected that request for the time being. I guess we have to acknowledge that reality. One of the suggestions I made when we were in Ukraine was potentially sending a military mission, not boots on the ground, not combat troops, but recognizing the fact that we're going to have to help Ukraine strengthen their military, not only short-term, but long-term. And so I would like to see a fact-finding mission of American military experts going over there. I think that would send a strong signal. You know, we were 8 U.S. senators, Democrat and Republicans. We flew a military aircraft into Kiev. That sent a pretty strong signal. Now we've got American presence on the ground, U.S. senators, maybe some military advisors. Maybe we ought to fly in on military transports, the MREs, to show Putin that we do mean to honor our commitment to, you know, maintain the border integrity of Ukraine. Putin will only respond to action. And that point was made very clear by Yatsenyuk, the prime minister. He said, you know, Putin's not going to, doesn't care about talk. He only responds to action.
Having just come back from there, can you see a war between the military of the Ukraine and Russia breaking out, sir?
But I hope and pray that doesn't happen. Certainly when I was in Ukraine, the press conference we gave after all of our meetings, I pretty well called out to Vladimir Putin. I said, listen, the person I blame for this is Vladimir Putin. If there's further bloodshed, if there's further expansion, if there's further aggression, there's one person, and only one person, that the world should blame, that the world should hold accountable, and that's Vladimir Putin. He has all the power in his hands to de-escalate the situation. And so I think we need to, you know, point that out.
Final question on this issue. Do you think what's the standing of America in the post-Iraq and post-Afghanistan world? Are we weak?
I thought Mitt Romney did a pretty good job in his column that ran the Wall Street Journal a couple days ago, basically said if you were to survey world leaders, if you take a look at it, across the globe, there's not one country after 5 years of President Obama that respects America more, that thinks America is stronger than it was 5 years ago. Now, there are many reasons for that, but that's a very sorry state of affairs, really, for world, you know, economic stability and just for world peace. It's not good when America is weakened, when America leads from behind, where we don't provide the type of, you know, moral leadership that this world really requires.
And a quick follow-up question. What's the single biggest step the U.S. could take to reassert itself as a force internationally, sir?
Yeah. Well, I would like to think politics ends at the border's edge. I've tried not to be critical of the administration. I want to be supportive of its actions. It's just very difficult when we've shown the kind of weakness. When you take a look at, you know, what this president's done over 5 years, you know, unilaterally, you know, not, you know, making the decision not to install those missile defense installations in Poland and the Czech Republic, not even offering words of encouragement to the Iranian students, going on an apology tour. Probably the greatest strategic blunder was not negotiating a status of force agreement with Iraq after we had sacrificed so many lives and limbs and the dollar commitment we made to Iraq, not to leave a residual force to stabilize the region, which would have prevented, by the way, the Iranian overflights supplying the conflict in Syria. So there have been so many strategic blunders, there have been so many signs of weakness, demonstrated weakness of the administration, it's hard to get it back. In a short period of time, it's going to be even more difficult with President Obama still at the helm. But concretely, what we could do today is what I was suggesting. Let's send in a military mission to send the signal that we're going to support, you know, strengthening the Ukrainian military so they can defend themselves. They will. I mean, that was a message that came across loud and clear. Ukrainians will defend their territory. I think we should install that missile defense shield in Poland, at least in Poland. I think they'd probably be willing to take it. And then, you know, we need to beef up, you know, certainly what NATO is doing in the Baltic states. You know, we have sent some more air patrols there. I think that's a good sign. Anything we can do, any actions we can take that will demonstrate to Vladimir Putin that we will block further expansion, further aggression on his part.
Yeah, I want to go back to a term you used earlier, hollowed out. Do you think Secretary Hagel's Pentagon budget would go back to that term, hollow out our U.S. Forces?
I'm highly concerned about it, and let's face it, the timing of his announcement couldn't be worse. As America now starts seeing, this is still a dangerous world. You know, Al-Qaeda has not been defeated. You know, possibly core Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan has been dramatically weakened, but Al-Qaeda is metastasizing. So, you know, you only have to take a look at the actions of Senator Obama, you know, his rhetoric against everything George Bush was doing, versus President Obama, how he's basically embraced every one of those actions now that he reads the presidential daily briefing. Even President Obama realizes this is a dangerous world. You know, I'd like to think that Russia is just a friendly rival, but that's not the way they're acting. They're acting as an unfriendly adversary. Let's hope they don't turn into an enemy, but I think the only way you prevent that is to change their calculus, their calculation, that they can't continue to do this. And that requires strength and resolve and a real foreign policy strategy, which if this administration has any strategies, just basically withdraw from the world, and that makes America less secure. It makes the world a far more dangerous place.
Thank you. Turning to domestic issues, the Office of Personnel and Management filed a motion to dismiss your lawsuit over how members of Congress and staffs are treated under the Affordable Care Act. Your response to their motion?
We fully expected it. You'll notice in their response, they didn't do much to really address the primary substance of our complaint, because it's pretty hard to defend when you realize, when everybody, it's pretty obvious that was a very political decision on the part of President Obama. It's also, I believe, pretty obvious that he does not have the legal authority to just willy-nilly change laws based on presidential decree. So their response really didn't address the substance of our suit. They're going to attack it, and they'll be hoping that the court doesn't grant standing, right. Which we always realize that's probably the most difficult hurdle we have to surmount, because it's always difficult as a member of Congress to challenge the administration legally, quite honestly, as it should be. But this is a very unique situation where I think we do have a pretty good case for standing. And I think it's a pretty important principle. If there's one thing that, one primary reason that I filed this lawsuit was to, first of all, uphold the rule of law, but to basically affirm the principle of equal treatment under the law.
You've mentioned some of the executive orders that the president has mentioned. The most recent one deals with overtime. Your reaction to that, sir?
Those types of decisions should be made between employers and employees. You know, I ran a business for 31 years, and we actually had employees that would switch between hourly paid and salary paid. A lot of people on hourly would request, the exempt status and going on to salary, so they had more flexibility in terms of hours. They didn't have to worry about clocking in and being tied to the time clock. So I think it's far better those types of decisions made between employers and the people that work with them than have a government dictate that will have very negative unintended consequences. It's hard to convey exactly the unintended consequences, the loss of potential jobs, the loss of income, the disruption in the workplace. I just don't think the federal government or anybody in it is smart enough to direct that type of behavior between employers and employees. It should be far better made between those individuals rather than have the dictate from the government.
Your first 3 years in office have been, I think, a pretty amazing time with all the international developments and some of the domestic developments. I want to ask you about the NSA, the National Security Agency. Have they broken the law, Senator?
I'm not an attorney. I can't really address that. I would go back to my previous answer when I talked about watching the actions of President Obama versus the rhetoric of Senator Barack Obama. When you realize that he's embraced most of the security measures of the Bush administration because he realizes this is a very dangerous world. I am highly concerned about maintaining American civil liberty. I'm highly suspicious of a ever-growing and more powerful federal government. That being said, the primary role of the federal government really is the nation's defense. Our best line of defense against the threat of international terrorism, a very asymmetric threat, is a robust intelligence gathering capability. So I believe Edward Snowden is a complete traitor. I think he has put the lives of Americans at risk. This is a debate that I think is a legitimate debate. What gives me a little bit of comfort in terms of the NSA and their activities is you have civil libertarians from both sides of the political spectrum. You have continuous monitoring, oversight by good people. I mean, Dianne Feinstein, Democrat, Saxby Chambliss, Republican. These are serious individuals. General Keith Alexander is a serious individual who's concerned about the safety and security of this nation. So, the people I see there don't take civil liberties lightly. They take the security of this nation very seriously. And so I think it's fine to have a national debate, but I just want to make sure that every Wisconsinite, every American understands that we live in a very dangerous world. And we need to make sure that we maintain our defenses, that we can have a robust intelligence gathering capability. It's the only thing that's going to keep us secure.
And all the data gathering practices that Mr. Snowden leaked, which one most surprised you, Senator?
To be honest with you, I'm surprised the federal government wasn't doing more.
Really?
Right now, let's take a look at the Malaysian Air disaster. We're all going, well, don't we have cameras up there? Didn't we track it all the way? Don't we have radar? I think we assume governments around the world have far greater capabilities than they actually do. What's at issue right here is the sweeping of vast amounts of data of, just a record, not the actual phone calls, not the content of emails in this case. It's just you called me and for X number of minutes. And the access to that data is incredibly limited. And it has to go through, multiple step process. And we've had a secure briefing with FISA judges, and I was able to assess how incredibly seriously they take their task of approving those requests. So, again, I would have, in a James Bond world or, the myth of what governments can actually do, I would have actually thought the federal government was doing more.
You mentioned Senator Feinstein. She recently saying the CIA had improperly, if not illegally, invaded the computers of Senate staffers. Were you surprised at that breach and that at what she charged, sir?
I was surprised, but I don't have all the detailed information on it. So that'll be adjudicated in some form. Obviously, from what I'd like to see is the intelligence committees of both House and Senate working very cooperatively with the CIA without that type of mistrust, because once again, we need that strong intelligence gathering capability, and we need them working cooperatively with proper oversight, people being able to trust each other. And it seems like that bond of trust, certainly between the CIA and at least the Democratic side of the Senate Intelligence Committee, has been broken, and that's not a good thing for America.
You said you were surprised the NSA isn't doing more in terms of data sweeping. Do you think they should be doing more to safely guard our citizens, sir?
I'm not an expert in terms of data gathering. Again, I think part of the controversy here is people are leaping to conclusion that you've got people in the bowels of the federal government listening into your phone conversations. You know, unless there's probable cause, unless you're a criminal, that you can be proved in front of a court that, no, we're going to wiretap you. That's not happening. So I think a lot of people are jumping to conclusions that the federal government is doing far more than what it in fact is actually doing. And, you know, so again, I'm just trying to take a look at the reality of the situation. I think it's a legitimate debate. I'm highly concerned about protecting American civil liberties. I'm highly concerned about a government that not only can, you know, potentially violate your civil liberties, but how about a government that can utilize the IRS as a political weapon to target its political opponents? How about a government that can, you know, legally take 45% of your income? You know, from my standpoint, that's really restricting freedom. When the government can take close to 50% of the fruits of your labor, I mean, you're only 50% free. So I'm concerned about the all-encompassing power and growth of federal government across the board, and but I want to be very realistic in terms of our intelligence gathering capabilities. I don't want Americans to be distracted by that concern when they need to be concerned about all the other vast power of the federal government.
Well, I'm struck because a top-ranking IRS official recently, in testimony, called before Congress, took the Fifth Amendment. Were you surprised at that?
Unfortunately, I wasn't surprised.
You were not surprised.
Incredibly disappointed, incredibly frustrated. Remember, President Obama said he'd be the most transparent administration in history. It is like pulling teeth. I mean, firmly rooted teeth is what we're trying to extract out of this White House, out of this executive, just to get to the answers of what was the IRS doing. This is probably the most feared agency in general of Americans toward government. And now you've got an IRS that is basically trying to silence free speech. That's the whole point of this. You know, President Obama is using his IRS to target his political opponents. And now they got caught. And so what are they trying to do? Now they're trying to change a regulation. They proposed a regulation that would force all these 501c4 organizations, which, by the way, are primarily growing because of something like McCain-Feingold campaign legislation, which hasn't worked at all. So much of it has been ruled unconstitutional. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we just have, well, I think I kind of got off the topic here.
I understand. You were elected in 2010 as a private businessman who wanted to fix things in Washington. You were not a career politician. So I have a twofold question. What do you think your impact has been in the first 3 years? What are you going to do differently in the next three, Senator?
If we're going to solve these problems, it's going to require Americans to fully understand the extent of the problems. I go through this explanation repeatedly, trying to ask people, or trying to get people to acknowledge, how do you solve a problem? Well, the first step is you have to admit you have one, right? You actually have to face reality. We don't have enough Americans, we don't have enough politicians in Washington admitting the extent of the problem. Then you have to properly define it. You know, we don't have a 10-year budget problem, we got a 30-year demographic problem, mm-hmm. which if we just concentrate in the first 10 years, we dramatically understate the size of the problem. So, you know, what I've been trying to do is gather that information, utilize my accounting skills, try and, you know, publicize, broadcast the most salient piece of information to describe the problem. First of all, to get Wisconsin's attention, America's attention, you know, kind of grab people by the lapels going, do you understand what we're doing to our kids and grandkids? Because until we do that, until we collectively admit we have a problem and then fully understand the problem, define it properly, any solutions we propose are going to be misdirected. And by the way, they'll have no chance of passage. So I think my greatest accomplishment would be I've pushed that football down the field pretty well. I got, for example, Director Elmendorf, after trying four times in hearings, to admit, unfortunately, that the Social Security Trust Fund has no value to the federal government as a whole. We've got an asset in the trust fund, but that's offset by the liability of the Treasury. You know, $2.7 trillion in the trust fund, $2.7 trillion liability. When you consolidate the books of the federal government,
wipes it out.
It nets to zero.
Yes.
So any politician that tells the American people that Social Security is solvent to the year 2033, I'm sorry, is just lying to you. Because you don't have an asset that really has any value with the federal government, and we're already cash negative in the Social Security Trust Fund. In the next 30 years, the Social Security Trust Fund will pay out somewhere between $13 and $15 trillion more in benefits than they're going to bring in the payroll tax. Medicare is far worse. There's a dollar that goes into the payroll tax, $3 are paid out in benefits. So over the next 30 years, Medicare will pay out about $35 trillion more in benefits than it takes in the payroll tax. Now, how many people do you hear talk about that? How many politicians say that? When I was in the White House working with the president, trying to work with, you know, the White House to let's figure out what we can agree on to at least start solving these problems, start taking a step, you know, push the football down the field.
Right.
My plea to the president was, let's go collectively, the American public. Let's show them this 30-year problem. You know,
right.
I told him it'll put everything on the table. Everything has to be discussed. His reaction to me was, Ron, we show the American people a number these large, and they're going to throw up their hands and, you know, say there's no hope. And he said, besides, Ron, we can't solve all the problems here. We got to leave some work for future presidents and future Congresses. Now, I saw your shoulders drop. That was pretty much my reaction, too. You know, well, Mr. President, how about if we just do a little bit of the work? But that's the problem. That's the frustration I'm finding. Let me tell you one further story. So then we're in the White House during the shutdown. And President Obama's at a lectern, and all of us Republican senators, probably about 45 or 46 of us, were sitting there listening to him. And then we had a chance to talk to him. You know, we either ask questions or make a comment. I was about the fifth Republican senator that was able to ask a question or make a comment. And, you know, without giving the entire comment, my main point was, Mr. President, you have a historic opportunity as a Democrat president working with Republicans like me, like Paul Ryan, like the people in this room, that are willing to take the political risk to solve these problems once and for all. So, you know, a Republican president doesn't have that opportunity. Look at George Bush tried to address Social Security, understood it was unsustainable. He got slaughtered politically. He didn't have Democrat allies in Congress that would take that political risk with him. So, Mr. President, you have 3 years left of your term. I have 3 years left of mine. Let's take those 3 years. Let's work in good faith like we were trying to do earlier. Let's solve these problems once and for all. Then you'll be going home to Illinois in 3 years. I'd be happy to return to Oshkosh, Wisconsin in 3 years, having solved these problems. At that point, our only rivalry would be Bear-Packer games. So please, Mr. President, take me up on that offer. He looked at me for kind of a long moment. Bob, do you have a question?
Oh, so he moved on.
I was the only senator that made a comment or question to which the president had no reply. To me, that speaks volumes of just the lack of seriousness, and that should demonstrate to you why I am so enormously frustrated. You know, having given up a life I love in Oshkosh to solve these problems and not having a willing partner on the other side to do it with us.
Your party is six seats away from controlling the U.S. Senate. How do you believe if your party controls both the Senate and the House, you'll still have the Democratic president? Do you think you'll be able to forge solutions to these major problems that you've just been talking about, Senator?
It would be my hope. Certainly what I've been trying to do, and you know, I've been the sand of the oyster in the Republican Conference about a strategic planning process, a bicameral House-Senate process where we collectively, in a fully coordinated effort, work with the House. I mean, as a senator, we're not passing legislation through the Harry Reid Senate, but we can certainly amplify what the House is doing. So my suggestion has always been, House, don't pass 100 pieces of legislation. Pass a limited number in a highly visible manner. In other words, you know, we should spend a lot of time talking about it, debating about it, have senators get on TV and make these points about why don't we permit the Keystone XL pipeline, and then pass a very simple, targeted piece of legislation that hopefully would put enough pressure on Senate Democrats that they'd pass it, and then maybe President Obama would sign it. You know, it's a political process. You have to inform, you have to persuade, you have to win the argument. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that's just my business background, you know, basically marketing these things. You have to win the political argument. But you know, the thing I'm working on right now is recognizing that President Obama is president.
Yes.
And we're probably not going to be able to repeal Obamacare. It exists now.
Right.
So how about well, first of all, acknowledge that fact that you're going to have to deal with people that are buying insurance policies. The piece of legislation I'm trying to work up, primarily with the House because they got to pass it, is not a full replacement right now because it has no chance of passage. But why don't we pass a piece of legislation? The working title would be Preserving Freedom and Choice in Healthcare. That's the objective of it. It would be targeted toward repairing the damage that's been done by Obamacare, limiting and preventing future damage. In other words, this piece of legislation would actually protect patients, make healthcare more affordable by the number one component would be let's eliminate all the mandated coverages. That's what's causing people to lose their healthcare plans. That's what's driving up the price of healthcare. There's a number of other things we could do on there, but pass a limited piece of legislation in the House that we could get a lot of hopefully publicity on that we would actually show the American people what we're for. And to me, that's the most important thing. We've got to lay out our ideas. They've got to be powerful enough. They've got to be simple enough so that we can actually win the political argument, maybe get put enough pressure on the Senate Democrats to pass it and enough pressure on President Obama to sign it, because that's, I think, where the real solutions lie.
We're almost out of time, so I just have two more questions. One of them, liberals were surprised on February 15th when you attended Madison Pastor Alex G's Justified Anger State of Emergency Town Hall. Why did you go to that?
Well, I take this responsibility as being a United States Senator for every Wisconsin citizen pretty seriously. And I'm concerned about every Wisconsinite, every American. These are some enormous problems we have. Problems with poverty, problems of racial discrimination, problems of racial profiling. I mean, that whole thing Reverend G held that town hall because he was racially profiled in the parking lot of his own church.
Yes.
That's a problem. The only way we're going to solve these problems is through a dialogue. So, you know, I've been doing this. Alderman Joe Davis was kind enough one day, saw me on the plane. Unfortunately, I didn't know who Joe Davis was. He recognized me, came and sat with me. We had an hour and a half long conversation on the plane, which developed, you know, started the development of a friendship and a sincere desire on the parts of both of us, including, and I would throw Pastor G in this thing too. These are good people that share the same goal. You know, I want to see a prosperous nation. I want to see every American have the opportunity to build a good life for themselves or family. Now, there may be differences of opinion on how you achieve that goal, but let's at least acknowledge, as we start grappling with these very enormous problems, that we share the same goal. Let's not question each other's motives. So, to me, attending that town hall, that's just a continuation of what I've been doing, you know, going into communities, meeting with groups of you know, all across Wisconsin, whether it's Hispanic, whether it's Hmong, whether it's, you know, chambers of commerce, whether it's African-American community, trying to describe the problem, trying to, you know, get people to admit they have it, trying to define it properly, mm-hmm. so we can actually design solutions that work.
And this is a follow-up question, so it doesn't count as my last one, but in the post-war on poverty era, what's the role of the federal government to attack poverty among the African-American community, sir?
Yeah. Well, first of all, America is a very compassionate society. I mean, I really do think we all want to help Americans that can't help themselves and help Americans help themselves. We all support a strong social safety net. The problem is, how do you design that strong social safety net where it doesn't start creeping into individuals and people that don't quite need it, or start expanding to the point where people are utterly abusing it and committing all kinds of fraud? How do you design a strong social safety net that creates the types of incentives for people to have the dignity of working rather than become dependent? Now, I would say nobody's yet designed that social safety net. But we got to keep trying, because we all want to help individuals. We all want to lift people up out of poverty. We want to incentivize people to work and obviously have an economy that provides the opportunity so people have the opportunities. So, I mean, to me, that's the real secret is, yes, we want to be compassionate, but the real compassion is, let's make sure that America is an attractive place for business investment, expansion, job creation, because in the end, it's having enough jobs, having enough opportunity for people to grab that bottom ring on bottom rung on the opportunity ladder, so they have that dignity of earning their own success.
And this is my final question. I know it's early, it's 2013, and the presidential election is until 2016, so it's 3 years out, but who's on your list of Republican presidential candidates who can do two things? Champion your priorities to meet these problems that you've outlined and get elected president.
Yeah.
Who's on your list?
Well, my list would be the same list you see out in the public. There are a lot of people that are, you know, expressing potential interest in it. A lot of those individuals I think would be highly qualified and do a far better job than the current occupant of the office. I think personally it's just way too early to be talking about presidential campaign. We've got a lot of problems here, both internationally and domestically. Let's concentrate on that. And my advice to any presidential candidate is put your nose to the grindstone, do your job, and then, you know, after 2014, after this election, well, then maybe you can start doing a little more traveling and start describing to the American people what you're for, what your vision of America is, how you'd start solving these problems, and really how you would get government to facilitate a strong economy, not dictate it, but facilitate it.
Well, so you don't want to get into the handicapping of the Christies and the Jeb Bushes and the Paul Ryans and the Scott Walkers.
Wasn't that kind of obvious?
I understand. Can a Tea Party candidate be elected president?
I think with the proper message, sure. I mean, I think the Tea Party, in terms of the grassroots individuals who certainly share my concern about the unsustainable path this nature's on. I mean, what does Tea Party stand for? Taxed enough already.
Already.
I believe most Americans believe that. Okay, I know it's pretty easy to think, well, boy, if we can just make the 1% pay their fair share, all problems will be solved. Well, that's simply not possible. And honestly, it's destructive to economic activity and providing that type of opportunity we all share. So I think the press has done a pretty good job of marginalizing the Tea Party, making anybody that would be associated with it like they're some kind of wacko bird. They're not. The people that support the Tea Party movement are patriotic Americans. They're hardworking. They're taxpaying. They are highly concerned about the path this nation's on. They fully recognize how precious America is and how it needs to be preserved because we really are the last best hope for mankind. So to me, I think the enthusiasm, the grassroots support for the Tea Party movement has been a very positive element. And I think somebody that would spring out of that movement that certainly identifies with those voters. Now the mainstream press will tag anybody as Tea Party. I mean, they do it to me all the time to marginalize me, so they can say that I'm unreasonable. Nothing could be further from the truth.
I understand. Senator Ron Johnson, thanks so much for talking to Wisconsin and I about your first 3 years. Hope we can do this again soon.
Be happy to.
Thank you, sir.